coming up on today's Compassion Radio.
During the beginnings of the war, a lot of people had fled to Beirut, so everything was in chaos. But the Christians were doing everything they could, absolutely living in the hope of Jesus Christ. Not hope for more food to feed their families the next day, but hope that Jesus Christ was eventually going to be the victor in the war that they were suffering.
From the heights of achievement to the depths of despair, Compassion Radio takes you to the very front lines of faith. Hi friends, Bram Floria here, and this month we spent some important time considering what has happened to and what will become of the country of Lebanon. Why? Because it's one of the great strongholds of Christian faith and family in the Middle East. And like the rest of the country, they've taken some serious hits this year. As you're probably aware by now, it's not just the coronavirus that they're dealing with. Add political and economic collapse and the worst explosion since Hiroshima, and you have a country on the brink of despair. Or at least it would be, if not for the kingdom of God in their midst. Who are these people that dare to have hope in the midst of hopelessness? Who clean up and rebuild when there seems to be no reason? Who care for the most vulnerable when they've already lost so much themselves? Well, they're your family. And today we'll put you in the middle of the action to reclaim the future from the devil's plans. Thanks for joining us today. Cher, welcome back to the studio today.
Thank you.
It's time to talk about Lebanon. We've talked about them in a couple different ways in the past few days. We've talked to folks that are on the ground right now that have experienced not just all the devastation from the explosion on August 4th, but how the Christians have responded, which is really kind of an old story for Lebanon. The Christians have always been responders. But I want to talk to you about the history of Lebanon. Compassion Radio has been involved with different projects and with a lot of people there for, dozens of years. Can you walk me through why Lebanon was unique amongst all those Middle Eastern countries?
Well, my first experience there was, right after the war ended. I'm not sure that it was completely ended, but the city was in rubble. Just utter devastation. You couldn't see a building anywhere that hadn't been destroyed in some way. Either absolutely been brought down, or the windows were blown out, or something had happened. It was awful.
And the city we're talking about is Beirut.
It's Beirut. Oh, I'm sorry, yes.
And there are a number of other larger cities that are not usually part of the international news cycle, but Beirut is the place.
Yes, it's the major city there, and as Beirut goes, the country goes. Yeah. Even at that time, we saw the Christians doing everything they could with nothing.
Yeah.
I mean, it wasn't like other people had been hurt and the churches hadn't, so they had plenty to give.
Yeah.
Their churches were destroyed. Their church families were decimated, either killed or had to have to leave the city. It was a very difficult place, and yet it was a city of hope. They were exhausted. I would have had no hope, looking at my surroundings and the years that had gone on of fighting.
They say it was at least 15 years of solid civil war,
yeah,
which is three times as long as our own nation went through their own civil war.
And of course, during the beginnings of the war, a lot of people had fled to Beirut.
Yeah.
So everything was in chaos. But the Christians were doing everything they could, absolutely living in the hope of Jesus Christ, which was not hope for a better place to live the next day or hope for more food to feed their families the next day, but hope that Jesus Christ was eventually going to be the victor in the war that they were suffering. Not that they expected him to come and bail them out of everything, but they knew that he would have the last word
in
everything that was happening there. Well, going back years later, it was remarkable to see how the city had been restored. There were still areas you could drive to see the remnants of the war, places that just hadn't had the economic ability to be able to rebuild. And for a few years there after the war, there had been a little bit of government stability, at least better than things that they had had before. And so there was some economic development, not just restoration, but some growth and some, and some real hope. And the churches have flourished, as is always the truth. When God's people are, to use the word loosely, persecuted, growth happens.
Yeah.
Not only in the church, and I use church not as a building, but the church at large, not only in the family of the church, but in those that have been touched by the church through the experience, the churches had grown. They were huge churches that had been built that were not there before.
It's important to note, too, that Lebanon is one of the most populous Christian nations in the Middle East. Iraq might have a few more believers before the wars all started in the early 2000s. Now it's especially true that the believers in Lebanon are the second largest Christian community in the entire Arab world, right behind Egypt.
That's right. And the most important thing about Lebanon in the Middle East was that it was the country with the most religious security.
They actually had a constitution that was designed for balance of powers between civil and military authorities and between religious groups and different cultural centers. So they were definitely a very multi-ethnic society crammed into a very small area. So they had to design a system that balanced the interests of the people groups that are represented in the government.
As you mentioned, Iraq had a large Christian component in the country, and there was civility between all of the religious groups, but it was imposed upon them by a severe leader. That was not true in Lebanon.
Right.
People had the freedom to worship as they believed, and at that time there was no regulation against proselytizing. Even though it probably did not happen a great deal, you were not sent to jail for witnessing to someone else
or someone perceiving that you were trying to.
Right. It was a very strategic place, particularly for Christian refugees to go when things were difficult in other places. But then, of course, in recent years, so many different countries had fled to Lebanon, refugees from all kinds of different things, religious persecution, government persecution, terrorists, whatever.
Yeah.
It had been a harbor for many people. But, of course, these were the lowest of the low economically. And those people were the ones most who settled down around the harbor because they could get inexpensive housing if they could get actual paid housing anywhere. And there were a lot of under-the-table jobs on the docks. So the people that were hurt most by this horrible explosion in Beirut were the poorest of the poor, and most of them were refugees.
Most of them were. And there also was a contingent of this upwardly mobile money that had moved in and started putting
in high-rises.
High-rises right next to it. I was amazed when I walked through Lebanon just 2 years ago, not just the disparity between rich and poor, but the heights to which wealth will rise.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you've got these ports where you have 30 or 40-story towers of gleaming glass with great penthouse suites and things next to tenements and other things that were going to be eventually bulldozed and made into new commerce. And then right behind that was the old city center. So you got a whole bunch of these things just crammed into a very small space. And they all knew that the disparity was great. But they all of people that I met, were at least satisfied that there had been peace.
Mm-hmm.
They were very afraid, though, because during that time of restoration or rebuilding, at the end of that came the Arab Spring, which was an outpouring of student protests and revolt against atrocities being done against them by different hardline governments around Africa and the Middle East. And it washed over Lebanon at the same time, too, because there was plenty of corruption endemic within the system because there was so much graft going on, skimming off of everything. But the prime minister at the time was known to be an honest broker between all the groups and was generally understood to be a fairly honest guy with all people that could vote for him, which was everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And he was brutally assassinated during that time,
which
set a whole spiral going off about, could there really be democracy? Could there be a new Arab Spring, a wave of freedom and increasing rights rather than diminishing ones? And then Hariri was dead. That was the big pause put on the hope.
Big time, because those who stepped in to take power and claimed that they were elected were not the people that needed to be in power.
One of the big groups that had the strongest sway over the eastern part of the country was Hezbollah. They had given sanctuary to Fatah and other parts of the Palestinian movements over the years, and so Israel was never happy with them. They're always squabbling back and forth. But in Lebanon, on the Islam side of things, you had both Sunni and Shia forces that were competing for political loyalties with the refugee communities and the expats that lived in Lebanon. And then you had all of these different Christian groups, and you had other groups. So it was just an incredible hodgepodge. It still is. But when you drive from a gleaming new airport through the slums, which is mostly Shia Hezbollah neighborhoods, and then you go into this gleaming western face of Lebanon, probably see Cyprus from the top floors of those buildings in the port. I don't know how to explain what it's like to step into a country that is part Las Vegas and part Grand Mosque in Istanbul, all mixed together, plus these great cathedrals and French and British culture all hodgepodge. It's a stunning place, and I've thoroughly enjoyed it. And then to find out the churches themselves, as you mentioned, are on the front lines of everything. They still are. And when I was there, they were aggressively going after all of the underground communities, ones who were in the country illegally because they're migrants that were not recognized yet. They were the ones doing all the work with them in the impromptu refugee camps that were popping up all over the country. Mm-hmm. World Health, UN, all the other organizations that normally would set up camps and things did not do that in Lebanon because there was so much private sector help and very little law infrastructure to protect them.
And wealth in that country.
All of that's been going on for the past 10 or 15 years now. What was the big thing about Lebanon for you, Cher, that marked it as being such a different kind of country compared to the other ones that you visited over those years?
I think because it had a very westernized look as it repaired itself. As is true in all tiny countries, property is at a premium. Mm-hmm. You can't just go out and build a whole new suburb and a whole new commerce district. Yeah. You have to take what little property you have and build as high on it as you can to get the most out of the property. So it was striking, as you said. There was almost a Soviet feel in the number of gigantic buildings, and yet none of that communist cement block horror. They were all very striking buildings, and it looked so westernized.
And it turned out that most of the money that went into that kind of infrastructure rebuilding came from the Middle East, Saudi Arabia, and the Gulf states. They were very involved with making Lebanon kind of like the Switzerland of the Middle East, a place to deposit your money and feel like it was fairly safe.
Right. But whereas those countries, as they built new things, went for bizarre architecture, as showy and gaudy as it could be, Lebanon had kept it very simple, very straight lines, beautiful architecture and beautiful interiors. But it was like this, as you said, almost a Las Vegas feel of a city that popped up out of the desert. And this one had popped up out of the rubble. To see the universities flourishing again and so many hopeful young people. It was just such a contrast with most of the other countries that we went to. Of course, we were there because of the severe refugee problem.
Right. And we mean severe. It's pretty severe. Not just in the magnitude of the money required to help feed and clothe and house the people, but the sheer magnitude per capita that was in Lebanon. You got a country that has about 5 million people, and now they have an extra 2.5 million refugees that have poured in. So if you can imagine any state in the United States of America, if you increase the population by 50%, immediately, and then they were just trying to camp out in your backyard, what kind of compression that would feel like. Everywhere you turn, there was somebody that needed help. Everywhere. Friends, before we jump back to today's interview, I just want to remind you that Compassion Radio is a communications ministry, and it depends on the faithful support of you to keep bringing inspiring stories to the air each day. Our vision partners support us monthly with gifts large and small, and make it possible for us to take you to the very front lines of faith. Whether you join our vision team or make a one-time gift, thank you for believing in and standing by this ministry. We're here to bring you real good news in every situation. Just call us at 1-800-868-2478 to make your gift and to request our special offer this month, the CD of Michael O'Brien's marvelous Crown Him music project, as our thank you. You can also text the word compassion to 53445 to give right through your phone or visit our website, compassionradio.com. Thank you, friends, for everything you've done and what you'll do today. We love you. And now, back to the interview. It's pretty severe. Not just in the magnitude of the money required to help feed and clothe and house the people, but the sheer magnitude per capita that was in Lebanon. You got a country that has about 5 million people, and now they have an extra 2.5 million refugees that have poured in. So if you can imagine any state in the United States of America, if you increase the population by 50% immediately, and then they were just trying to camp out in your backyard, what kind of compression that would feel like. Everywhere you turn, there was somebody that needed help. Everywhere. There's no place in the entire country that didn't. And yet they were almost invisible in plain sight, kind of like we think about our homeless communities across America. I'm not far from Austin, Texas here, and there's not a whole lot of unemployed and homeless people compared to the population, but it's large enough that you can actually notice it.
And in the news constantly as a major problem.
As in most major cities like Houston, Miami, Los Angeles, Seattle, and Washington, D.C., there are hundreds of thousands of people that are hiding in plain sight that live on our streets. Now imagine that every third person you saw was somebody who was in that situation but was hungry and eager for work, was not there because of mental illness, but because their countries had a mental illness and had totally broken down in warfare. Professionals, people had been doctors and lawyers and pharmacists and engineers, mm-hmm. being pushed out of their countries, pushing pedicabs and selling things on the streets.
Because it's illegal for them to have a paying job.
Correct. It's not illegal to help them, so there was no problem with compassion in the law. In fact, the Christians fought very hard to make sure that it was not illegal to help somebody. They didn't want to be morally responsible for the harm to another person just because they were in their country. But it was illegal to hire them. Mm-hmm. So they were forcibly unemployed. With no prospects, that's not a morally tenable situation.
I know, Bram. It helps us sort of picture it if we remember that Lebanon is two-thirds the size of Connecticut.
Yeah.
And we're talking about 2 to 3 million refugees having flooded into that country. Yeah. We would have a disaster if we had that many refugees flooding into the United States. But think of that tiny little country.
And Lebanon being about 6 million people, it's almost twice as many people as Connecticut has in it.
Mm-hmm.
So,
already.
Yeah. It has, as you mentioned before, because of the vertical rise where property is available. I was kind of surprised going through into the Bekaa Valley where most of the Syrian refugees arrived by foot.
Mm-hmm.
I'd always heard it was kind of like a hotbed of terrorists and extremists. And it had kind of a quasi-Old West kind of mentality there, mostly because it had been on the front lines of the civil war, and when the occupation came from Syria 30 years ago, they took over half the country and held onto it for a very long time.
And it had not been rebuilt.
No one put a dime into it until it was liberated again, given back to authorities in Beirut. But that valley, when I stepped into it, had a brand new superhighway being built through it on the way to Jordan. There was verdant fields. It was like a Napa Valley.
Mm-hmm.
The place was full of orchards and vineyards and produce, and a very small version of the Central Valley of California.
But of course, that's not the property that the refugees are allowed to be on.
But if they are, they're right in the very corners of these fields, kind of camped out. We'll see 1,000 people in areas about the size of maybe 2 or 3 houses. It's incredibly compacted. That's the situation that has emerged over all these years. But what I wanted to do mostly from you, Cher, was get mm-hmm. the idea of what kind of people are the Lebanese. You saw them on the front lines. They had been survivors. They had been downtrodden and run over by every other major country in the region. Kind of like what I experienced in Uganda a few years ago, finding out that those in current power in that country had all been refugees at one time, chased out by Idi Amin and his forces. So there wasn't a person that was in authority in that country that had not been through some kind of trauma, as had been in Rwanda, which was next door. Those in power had all been chased and threatened and tormented, and many of them killed, because of who they were.
Mm-hmm.
Lebanon knows that kind of trauma, and they chose not to become insular and put up a new wall. They had compassion. They had mercy on their neighbors. In fact, the Syrians were very surprised at this. Why would they open the doors to us, not only as refugees, but as people who had oppressed them
mm-hmm.
before?
Mm-hmm.
In fact, many soldiers were afraid to go to Lebanon as refugees because they knew they had fought in those wars against the Lebanese. And yet they were urged to come because the government says there will be no retribution against you just because you fought before. We know that you're being pursued by the government.
And at that time, no one expected that things would drag on as they have,
right,
with no hope of the Syrians going back to Syria because there is nothing to go back to.
Still,
mm-hmm.
the war still drags on, and we're just not hearing about it.
But you asked about the people. It's very difficult, I find, in talking with individuals to talk about the Middle Eastern hospitality. Somehow, with the awful things that have happened with the terrorists, we get the feeling that all Middle Easterners are harsh and cold and combative, and we just find everywhere that not to be true. And that's not just among the Christians.
Correct.
Part of the Muslim ethic is that if you are on my property, or you greet me, or you come to me, I am to be hospitable to you as long as you are in my presence. I'm responsible for you, to keep you safe, to keep you fed, to keep you happy. And it's just second nature. They don't say, oh my gosh, here comes the Americans, and now we have to be nice to them. They are, for the most part, gentle, hospitable people. We know that the men can be very hard-bitten soldiers when the situation calls for it. But at the same time, the hospitality that is bred into the culture is amazing.
Yeah.
And to sit, you know, as we have in so many places around the world, to sit on a tent floor where there's no furniture, only a couple of mats for them to sleep on, and a little gas stove with one burner where the mother can make tea and make one dish meals for her family, to sit there and have them serve us mm-hmm. what little they have. We tried so hard not to go into individual houses knowing that that was going to happen. It's not out of, we have to do this, we have to give them the food that we have. It is a culture that says, it is my honor to serve you and eat the few little cookies that they had or the couple pieces of fruit that they found somewhere. Or that culture can't help but reach out to other people in need. Now, there still are differences between the Sunnis and the Shias, and Sunnis would rather take care of Sunnis than take care of Shias, but...
Or their brand of Sunni.
Right. But if pushed, they will be hospitable to anyone. Sidetracking here, but we've been in Afghanistan and been in a situation where we were surrounded by men who were Taliban, who fought over the chance to talk to us. Mm-hmm. We knew that they were going out maybe that day, maybe the next day, to fight. But they sat there in their garb that distinguished them as what they are and laughed with us, talked with us, took us to a game I won't describe. It's very much like polo. never mind.
Yeah. It just involves a dead goat.
Or at least his head, right? Got a kick out of shocking us with what was going on. So there's a tender side in every soul. Sometimes the soul gets broken enough that that tender side just can't come out anymore.
And the dogs of war get loosed.
But we have found everywhere that people are genuinely compassionate and caring. And when they see that in you, they just love you.
Yeah. I know you're casting a very wide net about these cultures, because when you talk about the Talib in Afghanistan versus the westernized, very Western people of Lebanon, we're not talking tribal here as much. But Lebanon is very much a foodie culture. They love their love their food. They love sharing it. And they have a lot in common with the Turks and with the Greeks as far as their culinary styles. Mm-hmm. But it's very diverse. They are a people that loves to laugh. They just do. I mean, very long dinner times.
Good point.
And these are all people that have known harm. They've been traumatized, and yet they don't just laugh in a kind of gallows humor kind of way. They share from this wellspring that they know that laughter is life, and that if they can laugh together and they can cry together, they're healthy. They're okay. They're going to survive. It's when they have nothing left to give, nothing left to share, nothing left to feel, that they feel like they've died. And you and I have both seen that on the faces of some people coming into these refugee camps where the trauma has just been so severe that there's nothing left for them to give. They just have a flat affect and they can't engage you. And that's very, very hard to look at.
That was one thing that I thought was so encouraging post this last explosion. Some of the church people going down into the very devastated parts of the city found there already young people already sweeping, cleaning up, putting on Band-Aids, doing whatever they could. And it was not a group.
Right.
It was cross-cultural. It was cross-religions. It was any mixture. But the young people were saying, if we're going to have a country, it's up to us to clean it up and make it something.
Yeah.
I found that incredibly encouraging in the spirit of the Lebanese people, that they're not downtrodden after all of this. They had seen enough years of what could be a better life, if not the best life in the Lord, to say, we're not going to accept this.
Yeah.
That's in the spirit of, I think the Jordanians are that way too. Some hope has been so diminished in the young people in some of the other Middle Eastern countries that I don't think you would see that same thing. But the Lebanese young people are saying, this is our country. Mm-hmm. We're going to have to live with it. We're going to go clean it up and we're going to get started all over again.
Holy charity, mine outward vesture be, and lowliness become mine inner clothing. True lowliness of heart, which takes the shortcomings weeps with loathing. For none can guess its grace till of Creator bless.
Remember, friends, your giving this month doesn't just support this unique media ministry. Every dime beyond our baseline budgeting is going to support the relief and rebuilding efforts in Beirut, Lebanon, led by wonderful Christian ministries already on the ground and doing tremendous work. I strongly encourage you to give above and beyond this month so we can make the most impact possible. There is so much to be thankful for, even in hard times. Right now, I'm very thankful for you. Your gift of time each day is a genuine treasure to us. Knowing that you're being challenged to live out your faith like never before is a wonderful encouragement to us as well. I hope you'll take time today to drop us a note through our website or by email. You can reach me directly at the following address, bramfloria@compassionradio.com. However you reach out, know that we're in this ministry and this work for you and because of you. Just call or write us today to help keep us on the air and in the field. Call 1-800-868-2478. Our mailing address is P.O. Box 2770, Orange, California, 92859. And jump in anytime at CompassionRadio.com. We're waiting for you, friends. Hop on board.